Imagine stepping up to a keyboard, and over the next 29 days, you just completely reshape an entire software ecosystem.
Yeah, it's pretty wild to even think about.
Right, like you take five separate, totally isolated web apps, you merge them into one massive unified platform, and then you launch nine distinct product verticals.
And you do all of this with exactly zero domain knowledge in the product area, which, by the way, happens to be traditional fortune telling.
I mean, the raw numbers on this sprint are just
Oh,
staggering.
absolutely. We're looking at 1,134 commits.
Wow.
Yeah, that averages out to about 39 commits a day, every single day. And there were zero commit days.
Okay, let's unpack this because for this deep dive, our mission isn't just to, gawk at a highlight reel of a solo developer typing really
Right,
fast.
exactly. We want to actually pull back the curtain.
Yeah, we're using the developers' actual commit logs, their raw postmortem notes, and all the architectural diagrams they left behind.
Because we really want to look at the underlying infrastructure, right? The painful architectural decisions and the gnarliest bugs that make this kind of insane development speed sustainable in the real world.
Because that speed is actually kind of deceptive, isn't it?
Very. I mean, it wasn't achieved by just typing faster. It was achieved by a pretty brutal systematic removal of friction.
Right.
Like the commit logs show this developer aggressively designing systems so that by week three, adding a massive new feature took hours instead of weeks.
But, to get to that glorious frictionless future, you first have to wade through a whole bunch of mud.
Oh, a lot of mud.
Yeah. Because day one of the sprint was like the exact opposite of speed. The developer started with five completely separate applications built on Next.js.
Which, for those who don't know, is a really popular framework for building React-based web apps.
Exactly. And we're talking totally separate code bases here. One for Bazzi, one for astrology, tarot, dream interpretation, and divination.
Five different authentication systems.
Yes.
Yeah.
Five different database clients. I mean, users literally had to log in five different times if they wanted to use the different tools.
Which is just the classic silo problem.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot scale chaos.
You really can't.
So to go fast later, you have to pay the architecture tax up front. And the first step to standardizing this whole ecosystem was moving to a turbo repo.
Right, which is essentially just a tool designed to manage multiple projects inside one single giant repository.
Exactly.
It's like trying to merge five independent, fully functioning restaurant
Oh,
kitchens.
that's a good way to put it.
Right. Like if you want them to share a single pantry, which would be the new monorepo, you can't just shove them into the same building.
No, absolutely not. Every chef is using a different measurement system.
Exactly. You have to rewrite every single recipe so the chefs know exactly which shelf the ingredients move to. And that's what the developer faced on day one.
21 commits of pure pain,
Meh.
basically. Just fixing broken import paths.
Just imports.
Yeah, every single line of code that said, you know, go find the database tool here, suddenly pointed to a folder that just didn't exist anymore.
I can't even imagine.
The developer actually noted that just fixing those imports and verifying the builds took 80% of the time that first day.
Wow.
It is pure foundational plumbing. Like you aren't building anything new, you're just trying to get back to zero.
And then day two comes along, which the developer lovingly documented as CSS hell,
Oh, yeah. CSS hell is real.
because they attempted to unify the Tailwind CSS configurations. And for anyone unfamiliar, Tailwind uses these standardized design tokens.
Right, like variables for your colors, your spacing, your fonts.
Exactly. And when
Yeah.
you consolidate those tokens across five apps that used to be completely independent, the collisions are immediate.
Oh, yeah. One app's definition of the color, like primary blue, suddenly overwrites another app's definition.
Right. Or the spacing variable for a margin gets tweaked to accommodate the tarot app, and suddenly the astrology app just looks completely broken.
The quote from the developer's notes that captures this perfectly is they literally wrote, "Why is this button 2px smaller?"
Yes, I saw that. 38 commits on day two, and they weren't building any features.
Nope. Every single commit was just fixing these tiny, almost invisible visual regressions across the platform.
But, I mean, this is where we actually see the architecture tax start to pay off, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was grueling, sure, but by the end of that second day, they collapsed all this duplicated code across five apps into a single source of truth.
Right. So common functions like PDF generation, chat histories, UI elements, they were all finally centralized.
And that sets up the absolute leverage we see on day four. Because by then, The developer had standardized exactly how all these apps talk to the backend.
They created a unified API package.
Right. Every single route now followed a totally consistent pattern for authentication checks, credit deductions, AI model selection,
streaming, error handling, all of it.
Yeah, all of it. And because the code was finally predictable, the developer could just unleash an AI coding assistant on the migration.
They used Claude code, right?
They did. They basically handed Claude a single example of the new API pattern. And because the surrounding architecture was finally unified, the AI didn't get confused by five different ways of doing things.
Which is huge.
It migrated all 52 API routes in exactly 1 hour of wall clock time.
That is wild. I mean, doing that manually across 52 routes would have easily taken a full day, maybe more. Just incredibly tedious, error-prone copying and pasting.
Oh, without a doubt.
But because they suffered through the CSS hell and, you know, rewrote the recipes for the shared kitchen, they unlocked a massive velocity multiplier.
But here's the thing. Fixing import paths and standardizing CSS that gets the code working. But to actually make a product succeed, you have to transition from backend architecture to user experience.
Right. How do you take five highly distinct, frankly, very mystical apps and turn them into a cohesive brand that people actually want to pull their credit cards out for?
Here's where it gets really interesting. They found a unifying theme that completely abstracted away the complexity of the backend. They introduced PanPanMo.
The calculating fortune-telling cat. I love this part.
It's brilliant. Every app got this cat-themed treatment. But the psychological mechanism that really stands out in the notes is what they did to the Stripe payment platform.
Right. They didn't just charge dollars or cents. The platform currency became dried fish treats.
Exactly. Because psychologically, users are far more willing to part with, you know, five fish treats than they are to do the mental math on a specific dollar amount for a digital tarot reading.
It just gamifies the transaction exactly enough to reduce friction. Because obviously that's what you pay a cat with.
Right. But engineering that cute little dried fish economy required a massive foundational update.
Yeah. The commit logs call it the M1 foundation update. 100 files changed just for this one thing.
Because the challenge was merging anonymous users with authenticated accounts.
Mm, right. When a user first arrives, they're literally just a random string of numbers in the Supabase database. They click around, maybe they get a promotional code for free fish treats.
But the moment they redeem that code or officially sign in, the system has to seamlessly merge their anonymous credits, their past readings, their chat history, all of it into a permanent account.
And to do that without dropping data, the developer implemented a really rigid state machine.
Yeah, think of a state machine like a mechanical turnstile. Mm-hmm. A user's payment flow can only be in one explicitly defined state at a time.
Like idle, checking, redeeming, success, or error.
Exactly. You cannot physically be in checking and success simultaneously. It forces the application to handle the data sequentially.
Which totally prevents race conditions, right? Where an anonymous account and newly logged in account might accidentally overwrite each other.
Right. But even with that state machine, the developer ran into a really nasty crosstab synchronization bug.
Oh, this bug was fascinating. So imagine you're a user on the site. You have two browser tabs open. In tab A, you buy a package of dried fish treats. The transaction goes through perfectly.
Okay.
But then you switch over to tab B to actually get your tarot reading. Well, tab B hasn't refreshed. It still shows your old balance of zero.
And that is a scenario that actively destroys user trust.
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm. The user assumes the payment failed, they feel a surge of panic, and they buy the credits again.
And now they've been double charged, and the product feels like a scam.
Even though the back end worked flawlessly, the money changed hands, the database updated, the failure was entirely in the user interface's inability to reflect reality across different browser windows.
Right. And the traditional way to fix this is polling. You know, having the browser ask the server every few seconds, hey, did the balance change?
But that wastes a ton of resources.
It does. So instead, the developer implemented Supabase real-time subscriptions. Supabase is the back-end database they used, and it has this feature built on WebSockets that maintains an open two-way connection with the browser.
So the database actively pushes the update out?
Precisely.
Yeah.
The database pushes the new balance to every open tab within a millisecond.
Wow.
So the moment the transaction clears in tab A, tab B's balance counter ticks up instantly,
Yeah.
It entirely eliminates that window of doubt where a user might double spend.
Okay, so with the economy stable and trust established, the developer moved into the heaviest compute challenge of the entire sprint.
Oh, the MediaPipe integration.
Yeah, but wait, I'm looking at their nuts on this and it really doesn't make sense to me.
What do you mean?
So they built a feature called Shanshu Palm and Face Reading, and they decided to run a massive 478-point face mesh algorithm using Google's MediaPipe entirely inside the user's web browser.
Yeah, that's right.
But why? Why force the user's phone to do all that heavy lifting? Wouldn't that just melt their battery? Why not just snap a photo, send it to a server, run the heavy machine learning there, and send the result back like literally almost every other app does?
Well, because sending a high-resolution photo to a server introduces massive round-trip latency.
Ah, so the user's just sitting there staring at a loading spinner.
Exactly. By running it in the browser, they optimize for speed, cost, and privacy.
Okay, break that mechanism down for me. How is a standard web browser handling a 478-point machine learning mesh without completely crashing?
They used WebAssembly, or WESM.
Okay.
WebAssembly essentially lets you take heavy, complex software written in languages like C++ and run it right inside a web browser at near-native speeds. It completely bypasses the usual sluggishness of JavaScript.
Oh, that makes sense. But wouldn't downloading all that C++ code make the website take forever to load initially?
It would, which is why they lazy loaded the WESM module.
Meaning the browser only downloads that heavy code at the exact moment the user clicks the scan face button.
Exactly. And the result is a 60 frames per second real-time camera preview right on the phone. The detection happens instantly.
Okay, so that covers speed. What about cost and privacy?
Well, from a cost perspective, the developer isn't paying server compute time to analyze thousands of faces. The user's device provides the compute power for free.
Oh, that's so smart.
Right. And regarding privacy, because the mesh is generated locally, the raw, unannotated high-res photo of the user's face never has to touch the developer's servers.
But the AI still has to interpret that mesh to actually tell your fortune, right? Like, you can't just hand a large language model a coordinate grid of a face and expect to read it.
No, definitely not. The developer had to architect a massive four-layer prompt to make that work.
How did they structure it?
So first, the prompt strictly defined the AI's role.
Yeah.
Second, it injected specific domain knowledge teaching the AI about the five officials or the 12 palaces of traditional Chinese face reading.
Okay, wow.
Third, it required the AI to cross-validate those features against each other. And finally, it demanded a highly structured JSON output format so the web application could actually read the data and render it on the screen.
You know, rendering things on the screen actually brings up one of my favorite parts of the commit logs, the legendary portal theme bug. It was marked as PR67.
Oh, yeah. That bug highlights the friction between modern web frameworks and UI design perfectly.
It really does, because every single one of the 9 apps on this platform had its own custom CSS theme, right?
Right. The Dream Interpretation app looked visually distinct from the Tarot app.
Mm.
And they achieved this by wrapping the top level of each app in a specific CSS class, like .themeTarot.
So everything inside the HTML wrapper automatically inherits the right colors and fonts.
Exactly.
But then you introduce React portals.
Right.
And when you build a web app, sometimes you need a pop-up menu or a modal window. If you just put that modal inside your normal code structure, it might get hidden behind another element or cut off by a scrolling box.
Which looks terrible.
Yeah. So a portal solves this by physically teleporting that piece of the user interface out of the normal HTML structure and attaching it directly to the very bottom of the web page's document.
But here is the catch. Because the portal teleports the modal to the base of the document, it physically escapes the .themeTarot wrapper.
Exactly. The modal pops up and it's completely unstyled. It is just invisible to the theme engine.
And the developer's first attempt to fix this was a pretty brute force hack.
Yeah, they tried to make each individual component detect what theme it was supposed to be near and then forcefully hard code the right clack onto itself.
Which obviously becomes a maintenance nightmare when you have 9 distinct apps and 13 different components using portals. It just doesn't scale.
So what was the elegant solution in PR67?
The user React context called a theme provider, and they combined that with a custom themed portal component that actually utilizes a mutation observer.
Okay, and a mutation observer is a built-in browser API that literally watches the hidden structure of the web page, the DOM, for any changes.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the moment the portal teleports its content to the bottom of the page, the mutation observer catches it in the act.
Oh, that's clever.
Right. It dynamically reads the active theme from the theme provider and forces the correct CSS class onto the newly teleported modal.
So they updated 9 app layouts and migrated 13 components. It was clean, scalable, and permanently fixed the architecture.
But, you know, portals and database syncs are hard, but they are binary. They either work or they don't.
Right.
But what happens when the code works perfectly, but the actual cultural translation completely fails?
Yeah. Because the technology here was flawless, but the actual product was failing the reality test.
Right. Actual users were complaining that the AI fortunes were, and the Chinese term used in the feedback is Taohaohaosting, basically people-pleasing.
Yeah, and it's like going to a doctor who only tells you that you look great, your hair is shiny, your skin is glowing, even when your leg is clearly broken.
Which defeats the entire purpose of the service.
Exactly. People don't go to a fortune teller just for empty compliments. They want the warnings. They want to know what to avoid.
And this really exposes the underlying mechanics of how large language models are built. Out of the box, models are aligned by their creators using RLHF.
Reinforcement learning from human feedback?
Right. They are systematically trained to be helpful, positive, and harmless.
So telling a user they have a fierce or unfavorable fate goes directly against those core weights.
Yes. So the developer had to perform a systematic prompt overhaul to forcefully override that alignment. They explicitly instructed the AI, do not do people-pleasing interpretations. If it's good, say it's good. But if it's bad, explicitly point it out.
And for health-related readings, they even tuned the baseline tone of the prompt to be neutral-leaning negative to ensure the AI wouldn't sugarcoat warnings.
They literally had to force the AI to use traditional negative characters, and then they paired those warnings with specific mitigation strategies so the user wasn't just left in total despair.
It really required a human to look at the cultural context and explicitly tell the machine how to stop smiling all the time.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this cultural context also forced a massive evolution of the platform's content filter.
Oh, right, because version one of the filter was just a blunt instrument.
Yeah, just a simple keyword block list.
Mm-hmm.
If an AI generated a message that contained a sensitive word, the entire message was just blocked.
Which is super frustrating for a user. So version two tried to be smarter. It watched the stream of text coming from the AI. And if a bad word appeared, it just truncated the stream right there. It cut it off.
But the problem there is the user had already spent their dried fish treats to initiate that generation.
Right. They lost their credits and just received a half-finished sentence.
From a product perspective, it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically accidentally stealing from the users. So version three was the breakthrough. Inline masking.
Right. They built a dual filter architecture. So the input filter, what the user types, remains highly aggressive. It blocks ads, politics, pornography, and criminal content.
But the output filter, what the AI says back, is selectively relaxed.
How so?
Well, they explicitly excluded the ads category on the output filter. In the context of fortune telling, if someone asks about their career, a culturally appropriate AI might suggest they look for a part-time job or check recruitment signs.
And standard ad blockers flag those exact terms as spam.
Exactly. So by relaxing the output filter, the system allows the cultural nuance to get through. And if a truly banned word does slip out, version 3 doesn't kill the stream.
It just replaces the specific word with a placeholder that says prohibited word detected and keeps generating the rest of the reading.
Exactly. That saves the user's credits and still delivers the service.
Speaking of saving the reading, what happens if the user's internet drops while the AI is typing out this massive fortune? I know I've lost a whole bunch of ChatGPT threads just by switching apps on my phone.
Oh yeah, we all have. The developer engineered a really resilient server-side stream buffering system for exactly that.
How does that work?
All 19 AI streaming routes on the platform funnel their generated chunks of text into a database table called stream buffers.
So the server is actually saving the text state completely independent of the user's browser.
Exactly. If your phone loses cell service mid-reading, the server doesn't care. It just continues communicating with the AI model, finishes the reading, and saves the final result to the database.
And then when your phone reconnects,
it just fetches the completed buffer. You don't lose your fish treats, and you don't lose your fortune.
That is brilliant. You know, we started this deep dive by looking at this unbelievable velocity metric. 39 commits a day for 29 days.
Yeah.
But by walking through the architecture tacks of week one, the state machines and psychology of week two, and that resilient buffering infrastructure of week three, those numbers finally make sense.
They do. Because by day 20 and beyond, the shared packages were just rock solid. The unified authentication, the dried fish credit economy, the AI streaming buffers, the inline masking content filters, they were entirely modular and basically free to use for any new feature.
So the marginal cost of adding a completely new product dropped to almost nothing but prompt engineering.
Exactly. I mean, on February 15th alone, this solo developer shipped three entirely new products in a single day.
Three.
Because all the foundational layers were already perfected. It is just the ultimate proof that going slow and doing the painful unification work early is really the only way to achieve exponential speed later.
It totally forces you to rethink how much time is wasted managing chaotic infrastructure instead of building actual value.
Absolutely.
Which kind of leaves us with a question for you to think about. If you look at your own work right now, your own business, or, you know, that side project sitting on your hard drive, what are the duplicated five apps that are slowing you down?
Yeah, where are you paying an ongoing tax for chaos?
Because if you spent 4 days enduring the CSS hell of unifying your infrastructure, what kind of unimaginable velocity could you unlock on day 29?